success is going to depend how soon we can bring the insulin down by making it work, by restoring the function of insulin receptor protein, by improving the oxygen and oxygen-related detergents in the cell membrane and mitochondrial membrane. Well, how can you do that without doing the test? So in reality, when you go to a doctor and he tells you you have diabetes type 2, he's keeping you in ignorance. There's one question, $64 question, I suppose, I should ask you. Why do you think it is so? After all, no doctor in the whole world will contest me when I say that type 2 diabetes starts with insulin toxicity, too much insulin, hyperinsulinemia. Going back to Dr. Raven and Syndrome X, or then they replace into metabolic syndrome. Every time I hear the word of metabolic syndrome, unfortunately, even on WBI, I say, what are they thinking? Don't they want to think for themselves? What is metabolic syndrome? See, the difference is that when you say you have too much insulin, you have a numerical value. You ask the blood to arbitrate. You want blood to adjudicate the conflicts. And blood cells, so blood says, yes, I'm loaded with insulin. Good. We know the exact number. Now we know the problem. We also know that we have to conserve insulin so the body doesn't get depleted of its insulin bank reserve, lifetime bank reserve, and that would be then insulin-dependent diabetes. My point is, you cannot ask intelligent people to take charge of their health. You cannot ask intelligent people to have a clear idea of what our goal line is, in terms of measurable, reproducible, objective evidence of what goes on. And I will tell you, I will give, if anybody accepts my invitation, a professor from someplace, I'll give you case after case after case. I've published them, hundreds of them. My new book is about insulin toxicity. The whole book is about profiles. This music tells me that it is time for me to take leave. Please go to www.drleewan.org and you will have the full text of this new paper. And you will have a lot of examples until we meet again next Wednesday. May you be gracious, graceful, and generous in your spirit. Good night.
You think this war will ever end?
I don't know. They'll just have another one.
I want to get out of here. Don't you?
Not that much.
So you like it here?
It's not that bad.
You're in a foxhole with a war raging outside.
I know. That's why I'm sure glad I've got my WBAI.
Be glad you've got your WBAI. Become a member online at WBAI.org. Now, do it now.
There's a new show on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York called High Praise, starting on Sunday, April the 6th, from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. Tune in for an eclectic mix of praise and inspirational gospel music, spiced with Caribbean and African flavors, with a touch of gospel comedy. High Praise with Dalton Anderson, starting on Sunday, April the 6th, from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. on WBAI 99.5 FM, New York, your listener-supported station.
And that's where you're tuned, WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming live at WBAI.org. And as the fund drive has concluded, and we thank you all for your pledges, we urge you to fulfill those pledges, and we welcome back some of the people we have not heard for far too long. This is Earthwatch with Robert Knight. Please stay tuned.
Thank you. The bell for freedom still rings. The bell for freedom still rings. Sorrow to me, but does it ring to know the bell of freedom still rings? The hammer for justice still pounds. The hammer for justice still pounds. Heavy is the beating sound of the hammer for justice that pounds. Will the world stop and listen? When will we all stop and see? When will we feel what we've been missing? That the man in the moon must have. Cause he looks upon us with a frown, to know that millions of babies still starve. Millions of babies still starve. We can't have the biggest heart if millions of babies still starve. The innocent one still die. The innocent one still die. We can't value life too high if the innocent one still die. When will the world stop and listen? Will we all stop and see? When will we find what we've been missing? That the man in the moon must have found. Cause he looks upon us with a frown. Truth we won't let shine. The light of truth we won't let shine. Tell me, has the world gone blind? The light of truth we won't let shine. As long as there's life, there's still a day. As long as there's life, there's still a day. I know that we can find our way. For as long as there's life, there's still a day.
Greetings and welcome to Earthwatch on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York. In today's program, we examine the latest news developments regarding the NSA. Mass domestic surveillance on Americans and global citizens, congressional maneuvers, presidential feints, and so-called reforms of the Obama administration's continuing surveillance regime. Among today's voices, we shall hear former presidential daily briefer and CIA analyst Ray McGovern, FBI whistleblower Colleen Rowley, Roots Action founder Norman Solomon speaking overnight at a press conference petitioning President Obama and Attorney General Eric Holder for the return of the passport of NSA whistleblower and Nobel nominee Edward Snowden, whom we shall also hear, along with Senate Intelligence Committee Chair and Church Committee Pioneer Patrick Leahy of Vermont. And we shall also analyze President Obama and Congress's current bait-and-switch to transfer some NSA record-keeping functions over to private enterprise, while creating new pseudo-courts similar to FISA or FISC, and maintaining by other means the surveillance we already suffer today. That and more. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And this is Earthwatch.
Listen, every time you make a phone call, every time I make a phone call, every time your listeners call into the show to make a phone call, The NSA gets a record of that call. Listen, every time you make a phone call, every time I make a phone call, every time you make a phone call, the NSA gets a record of that call. The NSA gets a record of that call. NSA gets a record of that call. That call. Call. That call. Call. That call. Call. That call.
You can't have 100% security, 100% security, 100% security, and also then have 100% privacy and zero inconvenience. We're going to have to make some choices. We're going to have to make some choices.
Read the Constitution. What's wrong with that?
We passed the Patriot Act. We passed the Patriot Act. Patriot Act that allowed for this program to take place. That allowed for this program to take place.
You can't just do these kind of things.
To think that we would be collecting on every U.S. person, one, that would be against the law. That would be against the law. That would be against the law.
There is a program that the Director of National Intelligence has declassified. They've revealed it.
That there is no spying on Americans. No. There is no spying on Americans. On Americans.
That collects the phone record.
There is no
of every single American in the United States.
There is no spying
of every single American in the United States.
On Americans.
Of every single American in the United States.
There is no spying. There is no spying.
Regardless of whether they're connected to any terrorist threat, regardless of whether they're connected to any terrorist threat, regardless of whether they're connected to any terrorist threat.
They help us prevent terrorist attacks. They help us prevent terrorist attacks.
Oh, we have to do it for security. That's the rule of law. That's the rule of law.
Yeah, we don't have a domestic spying program.
Every time I make a phone call.
And that is a loophole.
Every time you make a phone call.
Allows for the examination of calls and email warrant.
Why the Constitution?
We're going to have to make some choices.
Of our obligation is keeping America safe.
The NSA gets a record of that call.
NSA gets
call.
A record of that call.
That call.
Record of that call.
That call.
Hello, I'm Barack Obama. Everybody log in. Everybody keep on signing on. Everybody log on.
If I can't hear what you're trying to say, if we can't read from your Facebook page,
maybe you have a secret, maybe you wanna keep it, maybe you are a terrorist. Okay, now they were close, try to domesticate you. You're a lone wolf, baby, it's in your nature. We're gonna liberate you, you better show us paper. If Allah is your maker, America, we're the good guys. Insurgents meeting,
we see them tweeting.
Gonna catch your beating, make a good word. We heard you fasted, that sounds bombastic. You make it plastic,
and it's a blur.
When you're Googling, well, I know I'm gonna see just where your Google search goes to. When you're on Facebook, well, I know I'm gonna see what likes and updates come from you. If you're on YouTube, well, I know I'm gonna see just what is in your videos. What I'll do with all this data is just something that nobody really knows. And I would pull 500 files, and I would pull 500 more, just to be the man who pulls 1,000 files, but won't say where they're stored. If you've got nothing to hide, then you don't have anything to worry about. Private info is not private anymore, it's for you to know and for us to find out. These encroachments on your privacy are mild. Soon you won't remember privacy anyway. We are spying on everybody in the whole United States. God bless the NSA. And I would pull 500 files, and I would pull 500 more, just to be the man who pulls 1,000 files, but won't say where they're stored.
Mining data, NSA.
Mining data, NSA.
You are listening to Earthwatch on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York. Our topic today, the NSA and a telephone surveillance bait and switch by Congress and the White House. As President Obama put it overnight at The Hague, to, quote, eliminate public concern, quote, about the NSA's bulk collection of warrantless personal information, only part of which is NSA storage of telephone call metadata, with even more pervasive web and electronic, commercial, computer, automobile, internet, and other tracking tricks taking place through the various agencies of the NSA's so-called PRISM program. According to an Obama-friendly leak to the New York Times this week, the President and House Intelligence Committees are co-spawning cosmetic but as yet unclear legislation that would continue to allow NSA access to customer telephone records with permissions for so-called two-hop monitoring, which means that all of the associates of any citizen whose phone is caught in the digital dragnet is able to be monitored. In the best traditions of privatizing and merging commercial and intelligence interests, President Obama's approach would shift to the gag-ruled telecommunications carriers the burden of maintaining phone and metadata records for the NSA. The plan also contemplates yet another transconstitutional spying court, similar to or a subset of the notorious Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, a shadowy pro-intelligence construction which has thus far denied only 11 out of 34,000 routinely rubber-stamped espionage requests by the NSA and affiliated agencies. That is a pro-intelligence rigging ratio of 0.03% of the requests that are denied. Currently, some liberal and pro-democratic party leaders are praising the president for seeming to oppose the surveillance regime he so vigorously supported right up until this week, when public opinion against warrantless NSA surveillance and bulk phone data collection presented Obama with an intractable public relations issue leading into the 2014 midterm elections. NSA camp follower Dianne Feinstein of California says she might hold congressional hearings on the Obama House proposals, but those hard of hearings may well not even be heard by the public for so-called national security claims. Perhaps even more significantly, there is something blatantly partisan and political lurking behind the Obamian curtain of public relations timing, and it is this. The uncomfortable fact that President Obama only has until the end of this week to routinely renew the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court's legislative initiative for yet another 90 days, by which time many Americans may have traded the complexity of Washington's NSA shell game for the patriotic comforts of an all-American July 4th holiday, celebrating the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and especially Fourth Amendment protections against unreasonable and warrantless search and seizure. This is Earthwatch on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI 99.5 FM. I'm Robert Knight in New York.
My digital life's on display. I'm getting spied on night and day by the NSA. I always feel
in the USA. We've got rights, they say. But lately it's said that dream doesn't seem that way. So grab my data, tap my phone, and I don't trust just what they say. Even when I'm in my home, I try to stay aware. I'm afraid I'll open my eyes and see some cops standing there. They have done nothing wrong, I've got nothing to fear. At this rate, it won't be long till our freedom disappears. That's why I've always been like.
You know, everybody who's involved with this debate has been struggling over me and my personality and what, how to describe me. But when I think about it, this isn't the question that we should be struggling with. Who I am really doesn't matter at all. If I'm the worst person in the world, you can hate me and move on. What really matters here are the issues. What really matters here is the kind of government we want, the kind of internet we want, the kind of relationship between people and society. And that's what I'm hoping the debate will move towards, and we've seen that increasing over time. If I had to describe myself, I wouldn't use words like hero, I wouldn't use patriot, and I wouldn't use traitor. I'd say I'm an American and I'm a citizen, just like everyone else. When I was sitting in Hawaii, and the years before when I was working in the intelligence community, I saw a lot of things that had disturbed me. We do a lot of good things in the intelligence community, things that need to be done and things that help everyone. But there are also things that go too far. There are things that shouldn't be done and decisions that were being made in secret without the public's awareness, without the public's consent, and without even our representatives in government having knowledge of these programs. When I really came to struggle with these issues, I thought to myself, how can I do this in the most responsible way that maximizes the public benefit while minimizing the risks? And out of all the solutions that I could come with, out of going to Congress when there was no laws, there were no legal protections for a private employee, a contractor in intelligence like myself, there was a risk that I would be buried along with the information and the public would never find out. But the First Amendment of the United States Constitution guarantees us a free press for a reason. And that's to enable an adversarial press to challenge the government, but also to work together with the government to have a dialogue and debate about how we can inform the public about matters of vital importance without putting our national security at risk. And by working with journalists, by giving all of my information back to the American people, rather than trusting myself to make the decisions about publication, we've had a robust debate with a deep investment by the government that I think has resulted in a benefit for everyone. And the risks that have been threatened, the risks that have been played up by the government have never materialized. We've never seen any evidence of even a single instance of specific harm. I'm comfortable with the decisions that I made. The best way to understand PRISM, because there's been a little bit of controversy, is to first talk about what PRISM isn't. Much of the debate in the US has been about metadata. They've said it's just metadata, it's just metadata, and they're talking about a specific legal authority called Section 215 of the Patriot Act. That allows sort of warrantless wiretapping, mass surveillance of the entire country's sort of phone records, things like that. Who you're talking to, when you're talking to them, where you travel, these are all metadata events. PRISM is about content. It's a program through which the government could compel corporate America. It could sort of deputize corporate America to do its dirty work for the NSA. And even though some of these companies did resist, even though some of them, I believe Yahoo was one of them, challenged them in court, they all lost because it was never tried by an open court. They were only tried by a secret court. And something that we've seen, something about the PRISM program that's very concerning me, is there's been a talking point in the U.S. government where they've said 15 federal judges have reviewed these programs and found them to be lawful. But what they don't tell you is those are secret judges in a secret court based on secret interpretations of law that's considered 34,000 warrant requests over 33 years, and in 33 years only rejected 11 government requests. These aren't the people that we want deciding what the role of corporate America in a free and open internet should be. The NSA's own slides refer to it as direct access. What that means to an actual NSA analyst, someone like me who is working as an intelligence analyst, targeting, you know, Chinese cyber actors, things like that in Hawaii, is the provenance of that data is directly from their servers. It doesn't mean that there's a, you know, group of company representatives sitting in a smoky room with the NSA palling around and making backroom deals about how they're going to give this stuff away. Now, each company handles it different ways. Some are responsible, some are somewhat less responsible. But the bottom line is when we talk about how this information is given, it's coming from the companies themselves. It's not stolen from the lines. But there's an important thing to remember here. Even though companies pushed back, even though companies demanded, hey, let's do this through a warrant process, let's do this, you know, where we actually have some sort of legal review, some sort of basis for handing over these users' data, we saw stories in the Washington Post last year that weren't as well reported as the PRISM story that said the NSA broke in to the data center communications between Google to itself and Yahoo to itself. So even these companies that are cooperating in at least a compelled but hopefully lawful manner with the NSA, the NSA isn't satisfied with that. And because of that, we need our companies to work very hard to guarantee that they're going to represent the interests of the user and also advocate for the rights of the users. The biggest thing that an internet company in America can do today, right now, without consulting with lawyers to protect the rights of users worldwide, is to enable SSL or TLS, sort of encryption, web encryption, on every page that you visit. The reason this matters is today, if you go to look at a copy of 1984 on Amazon.com, the NSA can see a record of that. The Russian intelligence service can see a record of that. The Chinese service can see a record of that. The French service, the German service, the services of Andorra, they can all see it because it's unencrypted. The world's library, Amazon.com. But not only do they not support encryption by default, you cannot choose to use encryption when browsing through books. This is something that we need to change, not just for Amazon. I don't mean to single them out, but they're a great example. All companies need to move to an encrypted browsing habit by default for all users who haven't taken any action or picked any special methods on their own. That'll increase the privacy and the rights that people enjoy worldwide.
That was NSA whistleblower and Nobel nominee Edward Snowden speaking a few days ago at TED. This is Earthwatch on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI 99.5 FM. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we now hear portions of the press conference petitioning for Snowden's passport and other human rights held at the National Press Club in Washington and introduced by Roots Action founder Norman Solomon.
We're all familiar with the term blaming the messenger. What we've seen in the last 9 months is a magnification and exacerbation of such a dynamic, denouncing the messenger, vilifying the messenger, taking away the passport of the messenger, and indeed trying to prosecute and imprison the messenger who, since last June, has provided the American people with the capacity to learn about what's being done in our names with our own tax dollars. In fact, to participate in the informed consent of the governed. We're also familiar in recent years with the saying, if you see something, say something. Edward Snowden saw something, and he said something. He saw the undermining of the free press aspects of the First Amendment. He He saw the undermining of the Fourth Amendment. He saw the full-scale assault on due process and other key aspects of the Fifth Amendment. Edward Snowden saw something, and he said something. And in the last 9 months, many millions of Americans have seen what's being done under the cover of the NSA and other intelligence agencies. And 100,000 or so signers are on the petitions that you see over there. And as one of the sheets that have been passed out here gives in some detail, tomorrow Ray McGovern and Colleen Rowley and myself will be presenting that pair of petitions, first at the State Department and then at the Justice Department. And we certainly invite you at 11 a.m. In front of the Justice Department for an update briefing on what has or hasn't transpired. We sent letters to Secretary of State Kerry and Attorney General Holder. I've been in phone conversation the last day with the office of the Deputy Attorney General, James Cole. It appears that this week, but evidently James Cole as second in command is not. We still would hope to meet with him tomorrow, but in any event, at 11 a.m., we can let you know. From Ray McGovern and from Colleen Rowley here in the next minutes, and certainly in the light of the news that has broken in the last few hours, it's clear more than ever that leadership on issues of protecting the First, Fourth, and Fifth Amendments, protecting civil liberties of the United States against the extreme encroachments and attacks by the NSA, that the leadership has come from Edward Snowden, and that our president, who has repeatedly gone on national television and in other venues, claimed in recent months that the NSA and indeed the entire U.S. government is not, as President Obama said, spying on the American people, that the credibility of the White House is through the floor, and the credibility of Edward Snowden continues to ascend. So in that light, for the Justice Department to continue its stance of overt hostility towards Edward Snowden, for the State Department under the Obama administration to continue to deny access to the passport of this U.S. citizen, Edward Snowden, and for our president to remain silent while top officials of the U.S. government speak on background and in other ways, saying in some cases that they would like to see summary execution, killing of Edward Snowden, we are still awaiting a renunciation of those statements from President Obama. So with that, I'd like to introduce our speaker, Ray McGovern. And for the benefit of those who are watching on video, I will mention that Ray McGovern is a former CIA analyst whose responsibilities included preparing the president's daily brief and chairing the National Intelligence Estimates. He's co-founder of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Ray McGovern was one of four American whistleblowers, including Colleen Rowley, who met with Edward Snowden in Russia on October 9th to present him with an award for integrity in intelligence. Ray McGovern.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay? Good. It's not everyone that's put in the position of having to defend a Nobel Prize laureate, but that's where we're in position today. As you know, Edward Snowden has been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. He's also been elected by the students at the University of Glasgow to be their rector. So it's a sort of an odd circumstance to be in the position of having to defend him from the establishment here in Washington. But that's what I'm going to try to do, just to give you enough information so that you know that there's another side to this very interesting story. Now, I'd like to begin by citing those folks that have really spoken out against Snowden, who call him a traitor or call him a narcissist. You know, my definition of narcissist doesn't fit a fellow who who stayed out of the limelight for as long as he could. And I'd just like to tell you that when Colleen and I and Tom Drake and Jessalyn Radek, when we saw Ed Snowden on the 9th of October, I don't know about the others, but my intent was to find out if this fellow was the real deal. And I came away convinced after 6.5 hours of conversation with him that he was not only the most articulate, the most serious whistleblower I had ever run into since to Daniel Ellsberg, but that he was to be taken seriously and that he was justified in his belief that finally something was going to happen. And when we see the president saying, as you know, as my son says, when I'd say, I thought I told you to take out the garbage. He's, oh, he's just about to do that, just about to do that. Well, there was a lot of garbage in the NSA, and the president would have us believe he was just about to fix that. He was going to do that anyway, right? He's going to do that anyway. Give me a break. So what has the president said about all this? Well, he said, for example, that, you know, this Snowden fellow, doesn't he know that I signed an executive order? That he could have availed himself of the protection that I would, you know, doesn't he know that? He could have just taken advantage of that. And, of course, the answer is this executive order does not cover Edward Snowden in any meaningful way. The protection says that he must go to the committees in Congress who are thoroughly complicit in all this activity, or he should talk to the Director of National Intelligence, who on the 12th of March last year, when asked, is the National Security Agency collecting any data of any kind on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans? He said, no, sir, no, sir. And you know what? That was the trigger. Snowden has said that when he saw that, when he saw the head of national intelligence lying under oath, then he decided to put in train what he intended to do. And you see that just a couple of months later that happened. James Clapper did lie under oath. His successor as head of the National Security Agency. Well, how shall I put this? Well, let me just cite the facts. He said that there were 54 terrorist events thwarted, great word, isn't it? Thwarted by NSA collection of the kind, the bulk collection. And when he was asked again by the Senate Judiciary Committee, he said, well, one, not 54, but just one. And what was that one? That was a taxi driver in California sending $8,500 to al-Shabaab in Somalia. That thwarted a terrorist event. So these folks are not very good at telling the truth. And that's the important thing, because no wonder that they would come out against Ed Snowden for doing precisely that. I have to agree with the New York Times. I had a little note here about what the Times said. The very beginning of this year, I guess they were trying to make amends for past transgressions. But on the 2nd of January, they said that there was enormous value of the information that Snowden revealed. And the abuses that he exposed, he has done the country a great service in exposing a runaway intelligence community. Now, I spent 27 years, well, counting my Army intelligence experience, almost 30 years in this intelligence community. In my day, it was not runaway. Did it do some abuses? Yes, but it was always because the president told him to do it. Now, how about this president? That's what I'd like to get into now. How does this president look at this? Does he know what's going on? Does he deliberately cover up for these people? Or does he not know? Is he being given plausible deniability, which, you know, sort of a trade tactic where you don't tell the president everything so that when he says it didn't happen, he's not lying? Well, I don't know what the real answer is here. I like to give him the benefit of the doubt by saying that, you know, he's only regurgitating what NSA and others are telling him. For example, the executive order. Doesn't he know that the executive order would be worthless for Edward Snowden? And there's something much more important. And that is The president has said that if we only had this bulk collection in place before 9/11, we might have been able to find out who it was in San Diego. As most of you know, there were two hijackers in San Diego communicating with a terrorist base in Yemen. We might have been able to find out that other telephone number and would have been able to prevent 9/11. Okay? Now, two big untruths there. Okay? Guess what, folks? This may be news to you. We've been trying to spread it around, but we need your help. Okay? We did have the telephone number of the San Diego plots, the terrorists. You know, it's as easy as caller ID, folks. And you can talk to anyone in NSA who will be honest. They'll tell you the same. So the president is really not telling the truth when he said, if only we had the bulk collection thing, we could have that telephone number. It was available. There was not just one telephone conversation, as the president claimed. There were at least seven. How do I know that? Because the head of the National Terrorist, Anti-Terrorist or Counter-Terrorist Center has said that, okay? And guess what? We not only had the metadata, we had the content of those telephone conversations. Why was 9/11 allowed to happen? Because NSA did not share that information outside the hallowed walls of NSA. That is fact, folks. And the person that brought that to light, the person who knew that first, his name is Thomas Drake was subjected to 4 years of persecution, prosecution, after which the judge in Maryland said to those nine Department of Justice lawyers, don't you ever dare bring a case like this to me in my court again, case based on such flimsy evidence. 10 felony charges, 35 years, all charges dismissed. Now, Tom Drake knew what the deal was with respect to what NSA knew before 9/11. He was, when they thought he was a crony, he was a newly appointed executive. They didn't really know that he had a conscience. So they gave him the task of finding out what information was available before 9/11, and he did. You know what they said to him? What McGinnis, the deputy director, said? She said, oh, I wish you hadn't told me that. Go on to a different job. So what we have here is a president who is saying untruthful things. And I lean toward the... toward the scarcely believable hypothesis that he is scared of these folks, that this is why when he came into office, he made it very clear that he would not pursue the torturers back where I worked. They're still walking the halls of the CIA. They're writing books. They're patting themselves on the back, and they're spying on the Oversight Committee. Hello? I think he's afraid. I think he's afraid of what might happen if he really tried to rein the security services in. And I never thought, after 50 years of watching things here in this city, that I would hear myself saying that. Now, what does that mean? Well, that sort of gives him the benefit of the doubt for a chance. In other words, if you say that he's afraid to ask the real questions and he's willing to spout the propaganda that they offer, that's real. That's not only unfortunate, but what we need to do as a citizenry, as an educated citizenry, who have access to these data, if you all are kind enough to put it in your media, there's a chance that we can rise up and say, Mr. President, we, like Ed Snowden, feel real strongly about our oath to protect and preserve and support the Constitution of the United States, an oath which I swore as an Army officer, an oath which millions of people have sworn. We take that seriously. Last thing I'll say is that Ed Snowden had a copy of the Constitution on his desk in Hawaii. And his coworkers have said, in a Forbes magazine article, have said he used to whip that out and he used to argue with us, because what he was asking was, can what we are doing be consonant with the Fourth Amendment? Now, the smart people say that NSA means no such amendment anymore. And General Hayden, who used to head up the CIA, says that the Fourth Amendment does not include probable cause. But in finishing, I think it's really important just to think about what the Fourth Amendment is, because it's very small and it's very succinct and it's very, very clear. The right of the people to be secured in their persons, their houses, their papers and their effects shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue except upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the places to be searched and the people or objects to be seized, period, end quote. There is no way that bulk collection of our emails, of our telephone calls, or whatever else can be square with that amendment. If they change the name of NSA to No Such Amendment, we have to change it back. Thank you.
Our next speaker before we go to your questions is Colleen Rowley. She's a former FBI special agent and division counsel who wrote a memo in May of 2002 to the FBI director, which exposed some of the FBI's failures pre-9/11. Colleen Rowley was named one of Time Magazine's Persons of the Year in 2002. She also wrote a memo to the FBI director, dated February 2003, with some hard questions about the reliability of the so-called evidence being cited to supposedly justify the impending invasion of Iraq. Colleen Rowley.
And I also was probably one of the last whistleblowers to get on a cover of a magazine. I mean, and actually survive. There are some others that have been in covers of magazines, but they're either holed up in embassies or unfortunately having to seek asylum in foreign countries. In the last 12, 13 years, there has been a sea change that has gone on. When they say 9/11 changed everything, that part of it is true. It absolutely is. It shouldn't have changed everything, but it did. Most of the failures of 9/11 actually turn out to be failures, and this is not me saying this. This is the 9/11 Commission. It is actually the Joint Intelligence Committees. They found that it was the failure to share information, not only inside agencies, as the case I wrote about Musawi was, a blocking, stovepipe blocking, but also between agencies. The CIA knew that those two hijackers had come into California, and they didn't tell the FBI until a couple of days before 9/11. Okay, so the FBI is like, why didn't we know this? We could have stopped 9/11. There were many ways that 9/11 could have been prevented. The last failure to share information of 9/11 was failure to share information with the public. Because actually, it turns out most of our recent terrorist attacks are actually stopped by fellow passengers, by street vendors in New York City. It does require people to be vigilant, but if they don't know what's going on, if the government keeps all of this information secret, so on top of a persecution of whistleblowers that has gone on, I tried to explain before the session started that the difference between being a good whistleblower and going through channels is that they've grabbed the 1917 Espionage Act that is way overbroad. It's unconstitutional because it actually stops the press too. It actually says the publication of information or even the reading of information. The last two sections of this 1917 Espionage Act were never ever enforced. Because it's pretty well known that they're unconstitutional. They were never enforced after Ellsberg. Very rarely were they ever even attempted to be used, even in truly cases. Now they're using it to keep the truth from coming out. And they are not only threatening life in prison, but that law entails execution. So it's not far-fetched to be threatening execution. These things really need to be fixed. And I wrote yesterday an article, and it was inspired by a cartoon. You can check it out on a few websites. I'm a Huffington Post blogger. I'm one of you in a very slight way. But I wrote this article called NSA, no problemo, until. And I think we are at that until moment. The cartoon is funny because it starts off with the NSA putting its antennas up and spying, and Congress says, go ahead. And then the second frame is more antennas are up spying on in different directions. And the Congress says, okie dokie. And then the third frame is lots of antennas spying all over. And Congress says, no problemo. The fourth frame is one of those antennas has come swung around now to be spying on Congress. And when you're at that moment, Congress says, hold it right there. I think that's what we saw 2 weeks ago when Dianne Feinstein gave a very dramatic speech about the constitutional balance of powers that the framers in their wisdom, as well as the First Amendment, freedom of speech, freedom of association, freedom of press, and Fourth Amendment rights against unreasonable seizure, they created a balance that one branch should have oversight over because power corrupts. And they realized after King George, after the experience, that they wanted to have this balance built in, that they wanted to have independent oversight so that this would not get out of control. And if you have agencies now, after 9/11, the new FBI director, poor guy, he was only 9/11 director for 1 week before it occurs. And then, of course, it changes everything, and he's immediately thrust in the midst of some of these orders that occurred right after 9/11 for warrantless monitoring, orders that would allow torture, violation of Geneva Conventions, all this whole series of things. He gave a speech, Director Mueller, to the ACLU about a year or so after, maybe 2 years. Many people were afraid that because of what had happened, there would be this great overreaction, and that we would go right back to COINTELPRO of the 60s, where they spied on Martin Luther King, etc. So he gave a speech, and he assured everyone in the ACLU audience that this would not happen. He would prevent it and stop it from happening. And of course, I won't say that he, you know, was lying like Hayden or whatever. Of course, this was early on, and he probably didn't know how this would all progress himself. And then when he's caught up in it, it just starts building. And it reaches a point, just as we saw at the end of Vietnam. I think we're at this moment now. We're at this until moment. The last 6 years of Vietnam, the FBI's COINTELPRO was going, spying on, planting microphones in Martin Luther King's apartments and hotel rooms. The NSA had a program, Minaret, and the CIA had a program, Chaos. For you people that are older out there, that comes from Get Smart, the old chaos group. We don't actually know very much about the CIA's secret chaos, nor the NSA's Minaret program. The reason that more is known about the FBI's COINTELPRO is because a group of activists got the documents. You always need documents to prove these things. They got the documents from Media Pennsylvania that show this was going on. And then, luckily, there was a person in the FBI, William Sullivan, who told the truth about J. Edgar Hoover thinking that he had the authority not only to spy on and listen to people, lots and lots of Americans and civil rights leaders and feminists, etc., but he believed he had the right to disrupt on top of listening in. William Sullivan said, "We sat around a table plotting these things, and no one ever asked, is it ethical, is it legal?" And of course, they didn't ask, is it working? That's the other thing. You know, is this even productive? That's how it got out of control and went on for the last 6 years. Well, the part of the Minaret program that just came out in September, and this is where it's very much on all fours with Dianne Feinstein's finding out that the CIA was so hell-bent to keep their 6,300-page, $40 million report that has thoroughly studied this issue of how the CIA got into waterboarding and torture after the tapes were destroyed. And it's still being stopped. It's still being thwarted. She's trying hard to get it out, but it's still there. When she found out the CIA was spying on her and then gave this dramatic spying or removing documents from their computers, etc., that is exactly where Frank Church was. It turns out that in September, one document came out about who the seven Americans were on this list of targeted. 1,650 Americans were targeted by Minaret. We don't know most of them. Seven of the Americans, though, were Martin Luther King, Whitney Young, who were civil rights leaders, not too surprising. Muhammad Ali, no surprise, because he was, not going to fight in Vietnam. Editor from the New York Times. Columnist Art Buchwald. I think he was the columnist for the Washington Post. Everybody's like, why? How did Art Buchwald get on the list being targeted? I guess he wrote something that was too funny. And then the last two, folks, this is where we're at. The last two we know of that were spied on were Frank Church and Howard Baker. Okay, there could have been more senators spied on and targeted by the NSA. Now, this is a serious moment where we've reached this. Again, things have gone to a point, and a lot of whistleblowers have tried to get out the information to the press that would make a difference. And we're at a moment now where it seems like people are waking up, including Dianne Feinstein, hopefully, has kind of figured out that it's not just on everybody else. It actually could stop me. You probably can't see my little flag here. And some people think it's like a traitor flag because it says, think, it's patriotic. If you consider, when I talk on ethics, if you consider that there's the ethical, the legal, and the, you know, what works, what's effective, what makes sense, what's smart. Okay, those three things all go into every ethical decision. The decision to turn on, collect it all, okay, there were people, oh my gosh, we're going to do this? Collect on Americans? That's always been in my head that was wrong. That violates the executive order. The executive order says you can collect on foreigners, but not on Americans. Okay, so it's unethical, it's illegal. Okay, the last part of this is that, what Ray brought up, which is that there hasn't been, for the billions and maybe close to $1 trillion that have been spent on this massive dragnet, the bulk collection that Obama is going to maybe rein in, that he talked about yesterday, to rein in, to make it more targeted, very good first tiny baby step. I would say it's just a baby step forward. It's a good one to rein that in, the telephony metadata. But Edward Snowden's documents show that there's at least a couple hundred more that have already been revealed by journalists. And some of those didn't get as much play, but they're actually of more concern. And so at the end of my article, I think that it would be ideal. Let's hope the spirit of Frank Church is in the room here who can understand this. It would be ideal for a new Church committee type investigation to occur. And Edward Snowden should be the first witness. He should be the first one to be called back to tell what he knows, as well as other CIA, NSA, and people should be given the freedom to tell the truth now, instead of being stopped, threatened that if they're an insider threat, in government they call it an insider threat, if you raise your hand with a suggestion, if you're under this kind of suspicion. And you're Frederick Whitehurst at the lab, and you realize that the FBI lab is not accredited, and you become a little complainer about this, they're gonna report you now to the Insider Threat Program. And so this has gone way too far. For good government, we need to tell the truth about all of this. We need a full airing in the Church Committee, and then the executive and Obama, Congress, all need to work together bipartisan, in a bipartisan way, and fix this and get back on the right path.
In terms of the passport, as you may remember, it was almost exactly 9 months ago when the last stretch of time, it's a little murky on exactly when the passport was revoked, but late June as Snowden was exiting Hong Kong. And we hear this calumny that somehow he ran to Russia. But it's a reflection, and actually in the pass out of the top sheet of these petitions that you have, I think one of the many thousands of eloquent signer comments alludes to this. This was the last place that, as things worked out, was safe for Edward Snowden to be, and that was Russia. And so the U.S. government was directly complicit and responsible by confiscating and revoking Edward Snowden's passport for having him be stuck in the airport in Moscow and be left with no other option. Now, it is true, to be fair, that Snowden did have another option. He could have come back to the United States and gotten the kind of treatment that Private Manning got, which was, according to one UN report, borderline, if not over the border, of torture. And how much did you hear from Private Manning, now Chelsea Manning, then Bradley Manning, during and after his arrest and throughout his captivity? This is an effort to silence through revocation of the passport, through forcing down an airliner of the head of a sovereign government in Latin America, as you may remember last summer. The Attorney General of the United States and the President of the United States are clearly today, just as they were 9 months ago, hell-bent on flipping over every rock and pulling out all stops to apprehend, if necessary by their lights, apparently even abduct Edward Snowden. And one of these petitions directly addresses that question. So the revocation of the passport and this continuing stance from the Obama White House, particularly ironic now during the news of the last day, that approach to Edward Snowden continues unabated and it continues to be reprehensible.
I think the burgeoning of all of the private contractors, obviously Eisenhower warned about the military-industrial complex a long time ago, way before it got worse and worse and worse in all of the private people. And when I was in the FBI, we had very little private intelligence people. That all changed after I retired. And there's a lot of problems with private entities working even under the so-called supervision of an agency. They don't have any accountability because their bosses are someplace else. They're not even working as in government service for the good of the country. Their loyalty is not to the citizenry. Their loyalty is to the profits and to their corporation. So what I've often said is, you know, government can have its own problems and challenges, corruption of government, and corporate concerns have their own challenges. They're in it for profit. The worst of both worlds is combining them. And it actually escalates what the threat of each of them is. We know that the private world is already spying for purposes of consumer habits and all this. They're gathering this information. And the government has its own rationale for spying. You know, they say it's on terrorists, although it doesn't work. And then you combine the two of those things, I think you're asking for problems. I think that they should be separated.
Just a little footnote here. As you can probably tell, I'm scared, right? I was born before World War II, and I grew up with all the tales of what happened with fascism. Now, I've been told, don't use the F word, McGovern. Don't use the F. They usually mean the four-letter F word. But I've also been warned not to use fascism. Now, when you get, as Eisenhower said, the government and the industrial complex, which now takes the form of multinational corporations, which also control the media, let's face it, folks. Let's see what kind of coverage we get tonight, okay? The media, parts of the Congress, which is now shown to be true, even parts of the judiciary, these 15 bogus judges that approved 36,000 FISA requests and turned out 11. When you get them all entangled here, you have something very much approaching what Benito Mussolini defined as fascism. Do not blanch before the word.
Do what I say, don't do what I do. I know what you do because I'm watching you. Don't you question it, don't you doubt it. Don't even think about thinking about it. God has my witness, life is a business. And busy, busy bees get honey for legitness. You're a machine in which a lot has been invested. Now do what you're told before you get yourself arrested. Fascism. I just want to do what I want to do.
Show these fascists what a couple of hillbillies can do. Well, I'm gonna tell you fascists, you may be surprised. People in this world are getting organized. You're bound to lose, you fascists bound to lose.
This is Earthwatch on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI in New York. I'm Robert Knight. The outrageous reach of NSA surveillance and warrantless data storage on American citizens stems in part from a clandestine interpretation of Section 215 of the Counterconstitutional Patriot Act. Senate Intelligence Committee Chair Patrick Leahy of Vermont put this in a historical context with his recent recollections of how intelligence was handled 40 years ago during the heyday of the legendary Church Committee.
I've always cherished to be with good friends like Gary Hart and Fritz Mondale. Senator Hart and I were elected to the Senate the same year, and we were immediately a chance to meet with then Senator Mondale and Senator Humphrey from Minnesota. The very first vote we cast was for the Church Committee. And I remember we were both the newest members on the Senate Armed Services Committee. And I was a junior most member. And the chair of the committee, John Stennis, as some of you recall, did not like the idea. You may recall his discussions, Doctor, with Frank Church on this. He did not like the idea of having a church committee. He said to Senator Church, you know, they'll tell me, the CIA and the others will tell me everything that I need to know. And Senator Church said, yes, but you tell them you don't want to know. And that was the difference. And there's a famous photograph by George Thames, is in the New York Times, and it shows John Stennis lecturing Frank Church, saying, you can't have this. And Church kind of looking at him like, you know, a man 30 years younger and saying, I'm going to have it. I was standing right behind as a junior most member, right behind George Thames. We took that picture and it summed up everything that went on. But people like Fritz Mondale and Gary Hart, others made sure, and Mike Mansfield, that we would have this. And thank goodness we did. Because that was the first time we really started looking and asking what our government is doing. And not accepting, well, we can't tell you because it would damage national security. It's a watershed moment in history. And I remain proud of that first vote. Actually, Gary and I had a couple other votes in that committee in April of that year, April 1975. We voted by a one-vote margin to cut off authorization for the Vietnam War. And they cast that vote over and over again, trying to change us, and we did not. But let's talk about the Church Committee. Through their work, and these are the people who talk further about it, Bill Miller remembers so well the aspects of what went on there. The American public learned of years of excesses and abuses that occurred in the secretive and largely unchecked intelligence community. And the revelations made clear that change was needed. They led to the enactment of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act in 1978, the establishment of the Congressional Intelligence Committee to provide ongoing, comprehensive oversight of our intelligence agencies. But today, now it's 40 years, almost 40 years later, and we're at a watershed. The USA Patriot Act has for years been secretly interpreted to authorize the collection of Americans' phone records on an unprecedented scale. And they learned that the NSA is engaged in repeated, substantial legal violations in its implementation of Section 215 and other surveillance authorities. Now, I don't condone the way that these and other highly classified programs have been disclosed. I remain concerned about the potential damage to our intelligence gathering capabilities and national security. And we've not seen things so sinister as the secret campaign to smear Dr. Martin Luther King that the Church Committee unearthed. I credit the Church Committee with the oversight powers we now have, and the Congress now using to take a fresh look at what our government is doing under the guise of national security. But new technology has led to the proliferation of data and surveillance on a scale not previously imaginable. And it certainly wasn't contemplated by the Congress in the wake of the Church Committee. None of us could have even conceived of the way data, information, communications would take place 40 years after the Church Committee. Americans increasingly live online. We create electronic records of their daily activities without even realizing it. All of us know you can't have the police just walk into your house and search through a filing cabinet for your records. Comes the other question when those records are stored in the cloud or in other people's databanks. Americans communicate a lot differently than we used to. We have a digital footprint almost everywhere we go. Those of you who walked in here with your cell phones on, you left a record of where you were. So that's why I authored bipartisan legislation to update our criminal law regarding the privacy of our email content. And that's why I think the Congress has to take a hard look at the authorities we afford the Intelligence Committee. The rapid change technology has dramatically affected the FISA court. Now, the FISA court is a good idea for oversight, but it's no longer simply reviewing wiretap applications to make fact-based classified assessments about whether individual surveillance requests follow a statutory standard. Now they're rendering very complex constitutional decisions about massive surveillance programs had major implications for Americans' privacy. We were discussing some of these at dinner last night. The tremendous difference in that 40 years, and that's why I think, Dean, you've done a wonderful thing having as knowledgeable a panel as this to talk about it. They're conducting oversight of highly technical programs that even the agency running them apparently did not understand and certainly did not accurately report to the court. Let me emphasize that. They didn't understand it, and they didn't accurately report it to the court, and they're doing this all in secret, and the court doesn't have the advantage of there being an adversarial process where somebody might say, what about this? In fact, a whole body of secret law is developed and has considerable implication for our democracy. Time and again, Congress was asked to reauthorize surveillance authorities affect our fundamental notions of privacy, but without the ability to discuss publicly those programs or the legal and constitutional interpretations upon which the government relies. Only recently has it become possible for us to challenge openly the government's false assertion that it is necessary to collect the phone records of every single American to keep our country safe. I mean, just think about it logically. If you're collecting everything, in some ways you could say you're collecting nothing. How are you ever going to go through it? I'm convinced that the system set up in the 1970s to regulate the surveillance capabilities of our intelligence community is no longer working. And we have to recalibrate. First, you have to address the scope of the government's national security surveillance powers, particularly when directed at Americans. In my view, and I've discussed this with the White House, the Section 215 bulk collection of Americans' phone records must end. It's not making America safer. And the government has not made its case that this is an effective counterterrorism tool, especially in the light of the intrusion of Americans' privacy rights. And I've introduced bipartisan legislation with end bulk collection, while allowing the intelligence community to continue collection under Section 215 and other authorities if it's properly authorized and properly targeted. And I think, I don't want to put words in Vice President Mondale or Senator Hart's mouths, but I think they would agree that Congress did not enact FISA in order to give the government dragnet surveillance powers that could sweep in the data of countless innocent Americans. That's not what the FISA court is for. Secondly, we need to take a hard look at the existing oversight structure. What we're asking of the judges that are appointed to the FISA court. I don't question their integrity or their dedication. I do not agree with those who caricature it as an unthinking rubber stamp for government surveillance. But we have to recognize the fact that the FISA court judges have assumed a regulatory role not envisioned in the original version of FISA. And they often evaluate the adequacy of guidelines and procedures and the government's compliance with them. But They have to evaluate that, what the NSA is doing, but when the senior officials at the NSA do not themselves understand the technical boundaries of the programs they manage, or when they give inaccurate explanations to the court, and they have, how do we expect the court to fulfill its role? It can't be done. Other oversight mechanisms, including greater use of inspectors general, need to be considered, as well as possible structural changes to the FISA court process. So the Senate Judiciary Committee will continue to play its key oversight role. We have a lengthy history of working on it, dating back to the 1970s, even before I was there. Its members have expertise in privacy, civil liberties. I have a wonderful staff who have all the kind of clearances, understand us, and can work on it. And we have others that we consult with. So I'm convening a classified briefing for committee members tomorrow. We will do that classified briefing tomorrow, but then we'll have an open hearing next week when Director of National Intelligence Clapper and National Security Agency Director Alexander will testify. And I expect open and candid testimony. And to that end, I'm working with Congressman Sensenbrenner, Chairman of the Crime and Terrorism Subcommittee in the House, as well as Senator Lee of the Senate Judiciary Committee on a Legislative Solution. I'm consulting with Congressman Goodlatte. I was encouraged by his views the other day. What I'm saying is this is not a liberal or conservative issue, Democratic or Republican. We're going to have a bipartisan, open response in the same way we did with the Church Committee, something we're not seeing on the Hill these days. We've got to come back to that for the good of the country.
I think it's very true. This is not a left or right issue. You know, our basic freedoms, and when I say our, I don't just mean Americans. I mean people around the world. It's not a partisan issue. These are things that all people believe in, and it's up to all of us to protect them. And to people who have seen and enjoyed a free and open internet, it's up to us to preserve that liberty for the next generation to enjoy. And if we don't change things, if we don't stand up to make the changes we need to do to keep the internet safe, not just for us, but for everyone, we're going to lose that. And that would be a tremendous loss, not just for us, but for the world.
This is Earthwatch on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI in New York City. I'm Robert Knight, and we thank you for listening today to a cavalcade of NSA-related revelations, including Anti-Seriatim, the following musical selections: Hello, NSA, by the Overstatists; The Times They Are a-Changin', by Mary Clayton; All You Fascists Bound to Lose, by Woody Guthrie; Fascism, by Sam Sparrow; Obama's Watching Me, by Taiwanese Animators; 500 Files, by Tyrannosaurus Rex; Blurred Lines, by Brooklyn's own Shorts Show Comedy Players; A Love Song for the NSA, by Truthstream; and, of course, our own theme song, The Bell for Freedom, by Stevie Wonder. We welcome your comments about today's Earthwatch with an email to rknight@wbai.org. That's R-K-N-I-G-H-T at wbai.org. And for Earthwatch, I'm Robert Knight in New York.
Baby, I really need to talk to you. I really need to know that you're listening. I need to know that you hear my heart.
Hello, NSA. Been feeling lonely in the world today. I got some things been on my mind, and I know that you've been listening. You had my back from 2001. This Patriot Act's been so much fun. Oh, people say you're all up in the business, but I need you more in mine. Yeah.
Hello, hello, NSA. How's everybody there doing today? You've been listening for all this time. Can you hear me now?
Baby, can you hear me?
Best kept secret in the USA. If you can hear what's in my heart, let me know somehow.
Let your tender software pick up what I'm laying down. Got some little keywords to be our sexy sound. Tell me what to say to really turn you on.
Gonna make you wanna tap that line that I'm on.
Al-Qaeda.
Ooh, Al-Qaeda.
Militia.
interrupt this program for an important bulletin.
Join R. Paul Martin and Pickles of the North on Back of the Book, alternate Saturday mornings at 5 a.m. We'll talk about science, politics, and details of our little lives.
Your thoughts, Pickles.
You betcha.
That's Back of the Book, alternate Saturday mornings at 5 a.m.
Freeform live radio in the dwindling darkness. Only here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
And you're indeed tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, New York City, WBAI, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. And, oh, you know, stalling for 7 seconds. Well, 6 seconds early. But, hey, let's howl. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Wednesday night, Thursday morning program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, an interview with Lucius Shepard from a few years back. Lucius passed away last week. Also, Dan Persons reviews Divergent. After the theme.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. Okay, let's see if we can follow the premise of Divergent. 100 years after the war. What war? They don't say. Maybe it's the Cola Wars. Pepsi won, but oh, what a cost. 100 years after this oddly nonspecific war, the remainder of humanity, or maybe just the United States, or maybe just Chicago. Once again, they're not saying. Our survivors in question have managed to attain a kind of stability by dividing humanity into five factions. There's the Amity, who are the farmers, the Dauntless, who are the soldiers and the police force, the Erudite, who are the brainy guys, the Abnegation, who are selfless, and also because of that form the government, and the Candor, who are compulsively honest and thus become the judicial and the lawyers. And if that were really so, Shakespeare wouldn't have had any case against them. So when the kids here hit age 16, all the teenagers undergo a test where they get drugged and a computer reads their minds, determining to which faction they'll belong for the rest of their lives. Unless they want to go into another faction, which they're free to do. But if they then discover that they're not suited to that other faction, which the test told them they weren't anyway, remember? It's too late. They can't go back to the faction they were pegged for, nor can they try another faction. They become factionless, outcasts, because in a world where humanity is on the ropes, this is a sensible use of manpower. There is another possibility. You can be diagnosed as having the traits of several factions. You would think that would be a valuable person to have around, and that such a person would be treasured and fought over by the various factions. But no, these people are called divergent and are feared and despised because, I don't know, because nobody likes a show-off? Look, Divergent is produced by Summit, the people who did the Twilight Saga films, and they pretty much know their mostly teen, mostly female market. As a metaphor, Divergent strikes at the heart of an audience looking uneasily at an impending adulthood and concerned about the pressure of locking themselves in for a future that they themselves aren't sure they want. And it isn't as if the metaphor couldn't work in film, but it takes someone with the verve, the style, and, frankly, the audacity of a Terry Gilliam, a Tim Burton, a Rod Serling even, to make this work in a way that the setup doesn't trip the "oh come on" censors every 5 minutes. Divergent is directed by Neil Berger, who a while ago did a very interesting mockumentary/thriller called Interview with the Assassin, and followed up with a flawed but also interesting quasi-fantasy/drama, The Illusionist, that got overshadowed by Chris Nolan's similar and also flawed The Prestige. In telling the tale of a young woman who tries to hide her divergence by leaving the family business of abnegation and deciding to run with the cool kids of Dauntless, in the process discovering a deadly conspiracy in the works, Berger is trying for a Hunger Games vibe, but between the wan performance of lead actor Shailene Woodley, a mise-en-scene that doesn't really push the hyperbole far enough to sell the metaphor, and an anti-intellectual outlook that has the brainy erudite as the mustache-twirling villains, using science as a simultaneously all-powerful yet weirdly imprecise cudgel, this doesn't really rise above the pedestrian norm. There's some interesting imagery during the hallucinogenic testing sequences, and if you love watching healthy, muscular young men and women climbing things and leaping on and off trains, that seems to be the Dauntless's main occupation, you get your fill here. Otherwise, at 2 hours and 20 minutes, Divergent is a real slog. I'm Dan Persons. If you love science fiction, fantasy, and horror film, please check out Cinefantastique online over at cfqonline.com.
Okay, well, one note to all of you, because I know everybody says it that way. Erudite? No. Erudite is a mischievous pronunciation. If you don't want to be mischievous, say erudite, or add an I in that word. There's only an I near the end. It's erudite. And erudite has become de rigueur, the way that mischievous was some years ago. But fortunately, mischievous is sort of like passing out of the language, but erudite, alas, is very much in vogue. But this is Erudite, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio for the moment, WBAI, at 99.5 FM. And my name's Jim Freund. This program is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program of science fiction, fantasy, and related fields of endeavor brought to you over these airwaves since 1972. And one of our friends, Lucius Shepard, died last week. He was 71 years old. He was a brilliant writer. He basically followed his own drumbeat, as you will hear in the interview that we are about to hear. Looking him up on Wikipedia, they say, classified as a science fiction and fantasy writer, he often leaned into other genres such as magical realism. And I have a problem with the idea that magical realism is not science fiction or fantasy. Of course it is. It is a description of stuff within SF. But his work is infused with a political and historical sensibility and awareness of literary antecedents. And I say, yeah, that's correct, except for the fact